The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Life is full of what-ifs, some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
You know, I don't think the economic provisions, you know, are investing in ourselves and other things like that are going to, I mean, they're not going to have any reaction really to that. It's more the sort of gratuitous swipes that you just mentioned and some of the policies regarding their internal issues that would be most, and certainly the, you know, Taiwan language and the language about rallying with our allies to contain China, that kind of thing is going to be the most upsetting. And you'll see a lot about it in the Chinese press when and if this ever gets passed.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, February 8th, 2022. Don't look now, but the House of Representatives last week passed the COMPETES Act, its counterpart to a Senate bill last year on competitiveness with China. What's in the bill? What would it do? How similar is it to the Senate bill? And how close are we to a major piece of China legislation? Joining me last week in front of a live audience at Lawfare Live was Susan Thornton, a retired U.S. diplomat who is currently a senior fellow and visiting lecturer in law at the Yale Law School and the Paul Tsai China Center. With her was Jordan Schneider, the host of the China Talk podcast and newsletter, which runs regularly on Lawfare. We talked about the legislation, we talked about the prospects for reconciling it for the Senate bill, we took questions from the audience, and we talked over whether this is a real start or whether it's just window dressing. It's the Lawfare Podcast, February 8th. Congress moves on China.
Jordan, get us started on this. What is the COMPETES Act, which the House just passed today, and why should anybody care about it?
The COMPETES Act is the House's answer to the USICA Act from the Senate, which is a vaguely anti-China pro-competition bill, which weaves together a number of different streams of legislation from funding semiconductors to boosting NSF funding, even to immigration reform. And let's not forget our coral reefs, which apparently also play a role in keeping America sound and safe. So this bill, which was just passed out of the House, is now going to go into conference where the Senate and the House will work out some of the relatively minor distinctions between the two bills that have emerged in the past year.
And Susan, talk to us about the difference between these two bills and how we should understand how close are we to a major piece of congressional action.
Well, I'm not the expert on what's going on inside the heads of Chuck Schumer and Mitch McConnell, but what I would say is that, you know, there's a lot of momentum behind both of these bills on Capitol Hill. It's basically to do things that the U.S. should have been doing a long time ago, beefing up funding for basic research, helping out the National Science Foundation, money for this semiconductor buildup that people have been talking about that we need. So I think there's a lot of, you know, bipartisan agreement around the fact that some of these things need to be funded. There's a lot of bipartisan agreement, of course, around the fact that we need to do this because China is going to eat our lunch and we have to compete with them. And this is a way that we can make sure that we're doing it. There's things on immigration in there and et cetera. But I don't know, you know, there's a lot of partisan rancor up there. It's an election year. Most people think something can be done on this by May. I think they've said they want to pass it by Memorial Day, but, you know, there's a lot of things that we have to get over before we get there.
Yeah, so there are some specific provisions that made it into the House version of this bill, which is not in the Senate side. The Senate side passed with an overwhelming bipartisan majority, and there are some bits in particular on the House side which may struggle to get Senate support. And it's going to be really up to Senator Schumer to decide, you know, what kind of majority he wants to pass this with, and, you know, how upset the more moderate Republicans may be about some of the somewhat more left-leaning in today's environment, more left-leaning provisions. So
what are some examples of that stuff that, you know, in the context, I think the Senate bill got 68 votes, so it was actually super comfortable. What are the House bill lost one Democrat and got one Republican? So what is the difference that makes, other than the difference between the Senate and the House, that makes one a partisan exercise and the other a decidedly bipartisan exercise?
Yeah, I mean, we had some House Congress people coming out saying that this wasn't the Competes Act, it was actually the Concedes Act, which I think is really taking it a bit too far. But to be fair, there were a handful of provisions which I think are going to raise some you know more serious GOP concerns. So there are two I want to highlight. First is this idea of a outbound investment screen. So as many of the Lawfare listeners know, we've had inbound investment screens through CFIUS, which has been kind of like retooled and reformulated through the Firma Act. But, you know, U.S. money going out in the world hasn't had a filter on it for whether or not it would like undermine U.S. interests or impede kind of critical technologies or transfer them abroad and so on. This is now going to be something which a recent report by some of my colleagues at Rhodium estimated was going to impact 43% of U.S. FDI into China, which is a sizable number.
FDI is foreign direct investment, right?
Yeah, so U.S. money investing into companies, building factories in China. So, you know, there are the H.R. McMasters and Ash Carters of the world would like for that number to be zero. There are some carve-outs, you know, for not to screen necessarily everything, but this would really reshape the way that money, U.S. money, is flowing into China. The other one I wanted to point out for you, Ben, is this are the handful of immigration provisions, which my representative, Gerald Nadler, finagled into the bill. There's a new W visa, which would allow for people creating startups to bring themselves and their spouses and children into the U.S. on a 3-year visa, which can be renewed if the company hits certain metrics, which like is another whole level of stress on starting a company, I can only imagine, would be tough to shoulder, as well as an exemption for foreign nationals on the numeric limits for their countries if they're applying for visas with a STEM PhD.
So, Susan, is there a coherent philosophy behind either of these bills, or are they just a hodgepodge of provisions?
I think there is not a clear philosophy behind these bills, because I think mainly it's to sort of make up some ground on some competitive areas for the U.S. that we haven't been able to get consensus on, funding for, et cetera. And, you know, they're using, I think, the cloak of kind of competing with China to try to make it very difficult for people up on the Hill to oppose it, which it seems to work, at least in the Senate. But, you know, the problem is, you know, it's going to be one of the only pieces of legislation that people think is going to pass in this year. So it's like a Christmas tree. It's got something for everybody in it. And I don't know how much of that is going to pass. There's climate assistance, $4 billion for the Green Climate Fund, climate money for the Energy Department, et cetera. Some Republicans have said they object to that. But the philosophy around it being an anti-China bill, you know, isn't totally clear. And Jordan mentioned this outbound investment screening provision. I mean, the way it's drafted, it, you know, depending on what you think China is to the United States, it could encompass, you know, everything. And we could have a sort of zeroing out of outbound investment from the U.S. to China in theory. So nobody thinks that's going to happen, I don't think. But, you know, it's just kind of a hodgepodge of things. And depending on how you're interpreting U.S.-China relations at the moment, which everybody seems to have a different view on, you know, you might come to a different conclusion about what some of these provisions mean, I think.
All right. So let's talk about the one that I think is the centerpiece for the bill and is in both bills, which is the semiconductor investment provision. Susan, how big a deal is this and why do people care so much about it?
Well, I think it's a big deal because we have a chip shortage right now and we're having huge supply chain challenges. We have a 5-day supply of chips that U.S. companies claim they have instead of a healthy reserve. Makes people very uncomfortable. It's affecting automobile production and et cetera. So I think that is the reason why at this moment in time, it's such a huge issue. But it's been a huge issue in the recent few years because the U.S. has lost the ability basically to manufacture high-end semiconductor chips and has sort of ceded the manufacturing of less than 5-nanometer semiconductor chips to places like Taiwan and Korea. And so, you know, the Intel and other U.S. Manufacturers are very good at the high-end design. They work closely with these partners in manufacturing to make sure they can be manufactured. But we don't have the indigenous capability anymore to do this high-end manufacturing. And people, I think, certently in Congress and elsewhere in sort of the national security industrial complex, think that that manufacturing capability needs to come back to the U.S. in order to secure that supply chain, both for security reasons, but also just industrial competitiveness reasons. They're not content to leave it in Taiwan and Korea. So the question is, you know, can we bring back this manufacturing capacity? Taiwan and Korea both have subsidy programs and a certain coziness with the governments. So this is a way of sort of leveling the playing field. But the big question is, can a company like Intel come back up to the level that TSMC in Taiwan and some of the Korean manufacturers have been able to achieve in the last few years when we haven't been doing this manufacturing?
Jordan, what are your thoughts on semiconductors? Overstated in importance or the real deal?
Definitely not overstated in importance. Semiconductors are going to be are sort of what drives the entire world and is where the sort of frontier of technology needs to keep progressing in order for us to live more advanced, productive lives. However, you know, I do take some issue with the way in which that the CHIPS Act has ultimately been formulated, because I think it is a little overweighted on these subsidies to fab firms. At the end of the day, you know, if what we really want is to sort of like boost up Intel or create a new Intel, a few billion dollars is not going to really change the trajectory. These are enormous firms which are you know announcing $100 billion investments in CapEx and R&D, and the money while nice, I don't think is going to radically change the trajectory. If I had my druthers, I would be more focusing on investing in R&D towards, you know, what's going to be seen after Moore's law, after we reach the end of Moore's law, when we're you know starting to enter a new technological paradigm, and there are opportunities for sort of the next Intel to be born. And I think it would behoove Congress to, yes, put money towards bringing advanced fab capacity back in the U.S., but at the same time, put a considerable amount of effort and dollars into the sort of R&D research, as well as support for small and medium enterprises, which are going to be the startups, which will grow up to be the next, you know, world-shaping fabrication and design firms. And unfortunately, the ambition of the funding for NSF has really fallen off as this bill has developed. So initially we were looking at a technology directorate, which was going to get $100 billion over 5 years. And that was going to be on top of, you know, a 10 or so percent increase in NSF. That directorate has now been cut down 100-fold. We're only looking at it in the House and Senate bills at sort of $1 to $5 billion a year over the next 5 years. And the NSF increase is only going to be in a single digit percentage range over the next 5 years, which is not as much as the Congress people want to spin it as this like huge radical investment. I'm ultimately coming away a little underwhelmed if this is going to be the sort of big push that America is doing to upgrade our sort of scientific capability and become more competitive in the critical technologies, which both the U.S. and China are sort of in agreement with are going to drive the next 10 or so years.
Yeah. And moreover, I mean, both the bills are sort of laden with this kind of sense that we're going to try to keep foreigners out of our technology production areas and sort of make it harder for people to collaborate with, you know, malign actors and countries that threaten our national security. And that's all well and good. Of course, there have to be sensible provisions there. But it feels to me like we're going to overcrank on that. And you have to realize that U.S. comparative advantage isn't in any of these other areas that we're talking about. It's in attracting all these most talented people from all over the world to come here to our research bases and collaborate and work on these ideas. And so it is a little bit worrisome, I think, in the U.S., you know, the America Competes Act, that we're sort of going in the opposite direction. And I know immigration is a sensitive issue, but getting these STEM graduates from the rest of the world while we beef up our own STEM education system, you know, we can't do this immediately.
All right. So I want to ask a blunt and impolitic question in light of what you both have just said. Is this bill a good thing? I mean, it's a lot of money, according to Jordan, for sort of the wrong investment in semiconductors. It's a tiny fraction of the money that you would like to see in NSF and the new directorate. Maybe at the end of the day, Congress has just kind of blown it here. And, you know, they get to say they have a big China competitiveness bill, but it's not actually a very good bill. What do you think? Is at the end of the day, should Congress not pass this, or is this better passed than not passed?
Well, I mean, I think it would have been nice if we could have just passed sort of the CHIPS Act, you know, the pieces of the bill that were originally put forward. You know, the way that Congress works, I mean, I think it was Marco Rubio said, you know, if we can't get a bill like this passed, then we should just shut the place down. I mean, you know, maybe the latter sentiment is really what should be operative at this point. I mean, it's really hard with the kind of procedural hamstringing that happens up there to see how things that are sensible, like more funding for basic research, can get passed without building it up into a big, you know, Christmas tree anti-China bill. So could the bill be better? Absolutely. Do we need money for these kinds of innovation areas? Yes. Do we need this much money in these areas? Probably not. Do we need a lot of the other provisions that are probably going to hamstring those innovation efforts? Probably not. But on balance, you know, I think it's something that we need to do to fund our innovation base.
Jordan, what do you think? If you could wave a magic wand and either the Competes Act becomes law, the Senate version becomes law, or they both turn into a vaporous puff and disappear and Congress starts over again or doesn't, which do you do?
Well, I think Congress starting over again would mean no bill ever. So I'm going to pass on that one. What I would do was take the initial young Schumer NSF Endless Frontier bill from circa, you know, May 2021, and then layer that on top of what we've seen in the House. And I actually think, you know, to push back on you a little, Susan, I do think there's a relatively decent theory of the case. And, you know, even if the kind of different ways that the Congress is tackling the sort of gambit of issues, I do see a fair amount of progress in some things we haven't necessarily talked about it much. I mean, there's a lot of funding for Mandarin study, something near and dear to my heart. We have gestures towards, you know, a response to the Belt and Road Initiative to sort of put a more U.S. inflected approach to development finance around the world. There's a lot of good language in there around supporting cooperation with allies in responding to Chinese coercion, which I think is something that definitely needs more attention coming out of the legislative and executive branch. And, you know, beggars can't be choosers here. We haven't had a real plus up to R&D in you know, probably since the Cold War. So the fact that I'm not getting my 20-25% annual increases, but are we going to have to slum it with 7-9%? I think is still a win. Look, at the end of the day, maybe it was too ambitious and youthfully optimistic of me to hope that you would see some real bureaucratic changes to the way the NSF does business and a real sort of grasping towards doing more applied research and funding, you know, younger researchers in more innovative ways and lessening the burden on scientists in all their grant making and whatnot. But I do think there's a lot to be commended out of Congress kind of putting their heads together and kind of responding to the China challenge and at least a pretty good first effort.
So there's a pretty wide gap between you and the two in the answer to that question. You sound pretty optimistic, Jordan. I guess to put a fine point on it, you would take either of these bills over status quo?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's hard to imagine a world in which this bill, as it stands, fundamentally sort of changes America's trajectory. I think because the changes that are in it are relatively piecemeal. So given that, on balance, yes, I would take the kind of good and the bad in this legislation. But I don't think it's a sort of revolutionary piece of legislation which has a you know, enormously high upside.
And Susan, would you take either of these bills over the status quo?
I want to get the funding for basic research, but I guess I am a little bit, I mean, I spent 30 years in government. Maybe I'm a little bit more of a skeptic about what government's going to be able to do in general in the sort of area of building up our, you know, economic competitiveness. So, you know, a little bit more funding for basic research, I think, is great. You know, some help with trying to get more talent into the U.S. is great if the U.S. government can do that, which I think the jury's still out on that. But yeah, I think more funding for basic research is great. I and so in that sense, you know, there's a lot of provisions of the bill that I think are not helpful, that are grandstanding, that are gratuitous, but that comes with the territory. So, you know, I would probably prefer the Senate version. And I think it's important that it gets bipartisan support. So that's where I would probably come out.
All right. So let's talk about what should happen in the conference, because it sounds like there's some good stuff, some bad stuff. What would you like to see come out as we work toward a final bill, Susan?
Come out of the bill?
Yeah. I mean, we're going to take a Senate bill that you prefer, a House bill that's, they're both Christmas trees. They both have provisions the other one doesn't have. If you could, you know, sometimes the temptation in a conference committee is to lard it with the things that make it popular in both houses. It gets more Christmas tree-like, but you could also imagine it getting a little sparer if you were chairing the conference committee. Sounds like you would strip a lot of stuff out.
I go for spare, yes.
So always. What does the spare version look like? And what are the provisions that if you were a member of the conference committee, you would say, bring the meat axe down on this, on this, on this? What do you want to see come out of the House or Senate bills?
Well, I don't think there's a lot of meat other than the semiconductors, right? $52 billion. And then, you know, there's a lot of little money for a lot of little things. You know, and I don't know, you know, frankly, a Commerce Department office to monitor supply chains, you know, at $500 million, I'm not sure that that is necessary. You know, maybe it's a good thing, but, you know, it's sort of, it's not moving me. I think a lot of the other things, you know, in the House bill, sort of the money for the energy department. I mean, I'd like to see us do something for climate change, so I would probably be in favor of that. But if it goes, it's not gonna break my heart. But I think the basic funding for research is the main thing that I would want to see in. So, you know, the NSF and the semiconductor support is not necessary. I mean, I'm kind of with Jordan on that one. I don't know if that's the thing that we need to do to make ourselves the most competitive in semiconductor manufacturing, but it looks like we're going to do it. And then, you know, the Endless Frontier Act. I mean, I think a lot of the other stuff is just kind of, you know, have the State Department do a report on this, have the, you know, Commerce Department do a report on that. It doesn't move the needle in my view.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress. It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about UnitedHealthcare coverage at UH1.com. That's UH1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. Want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers and that the one with the most information about me was called Hleck. I have no idea what Hleck is. So the other day, I got my latest report and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there. And these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code LAWFARE20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/LAWFARE20, code
Lawfare 20.
Jordan, what about you? If you were chairing the conference committee, what would you be most keen to kill, and what would you be most keen? I assume you would want to put more money in the NSF stuff, but what would be your priorities?
Yeah, I mean, I think the sort of Commerce Department supply chain overwatch $500 million is a really interesting one, because it sort of speaks to a broader theme in this legislation and other legislation of America's rekindled interest in industrial policy. And I think in order to, there's a big debate about whether or not it makes sense to have more industrial policy in the U.S., but I think sort of America's hand is being forced, in a sense, both by sort of Chinese direct investment in subsidizing its high technology firms, as well as the rest of the world. You know, the EU is about to have its own CHIPS Act, and sort of the South Korea, Taiwan, Japan, all of the leading high technology countries in the world are putting their money where their mouth is in order to support their leading firms. So the first step, I think, is building the sort of institutional capacity within the U.S. government to understand what's happening at a high level in these important industries. And that sort of capacity building, I think, may not necessarily pay dividends in the next year or two, like money going out to help Samsung build a fab in Phoenix would. But at the same time, that sort of capacity for the U.S. government to upgrade itself and then be able to implement policies at a higher level with more skill and industry knowledge baked into what they're doing with all this money they're about to spend, I think is really important. And that sort of kind of investment in itself, the investment of the government in itself, isn't something that should be discounted.
Okay, we are going to go to audience questions. Joining from Finland, Antti Ruokonen, the floor is yours.
Thanks, Ben. So Jordan kind of circled around this already. Is there anything in the legislation specifically towards countering Chinese influence and economic clout in Africa and other resource-rich regions? And could you kind of go into detail about if there's something going on like that in either Congress or in the White House, if they're thinking about actually doing something about it? Thanks.
Sure. So I actually, there were gestures towards stuff like this, but there wasn't a kind of big, here's our answer to the Belt and Road. I think there were a handful of, we need to come up with a strategy to counter Chinese influence in Africa and, multiply that for every other region in the world. So there'll be a lot of paper writing, but Congress, I feel like, punted a little bit in just asking the executive branch to kind of come up with an answer, as opposed to really putting their money where their mouth is and appropriating or authorizing money to support the development organizations that the U.S. government already has that could potentially step up and fill the perceived void.
Susan, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree that if we were really serious about this, we would have seen some money attached to some of these exhortations to do more to counter the Belt and Road, and we really haven't seen that. So until you have some kind of real resources to work with, it's going to be hard.
What would a project like that actually look like? So if Congress were going to put its money where its mouth is and wanted to really, create a alternative to the Belt and Road, what would a program of that nature look like?
Well, I mean, I think it would be pretty hard, because basically, U.S. firms, And I mean, that's what the Chinese have done, right? They have all these U.S. I mean, they have all these Chinese construction firms, Chinese, health companies, Chinese telecommunications firms that go out and, construct these projects in pretty high risk places. And the Chinese government finances it. We have not really had the firms that are going to be going out and doing that. So what we've been doing is partnering with countries that do have competitors like Japan, like Korea, others, Israel, and help to sort of finance these projects or think about helping to finance these projects, which is what sort of the Development Finance Corporation is doing, that was given money through the Build Act back a few years ago under the Trump administration. But I mean, the amount of money the DFC has is minuscule compared to the Belt and Road Initiative. So what we've been trying to do is work together with other partners who have, like the Japan Bank for International Cooperation, the Korean equivalent, some of the others who are doing projects around, and work with them on financing and other efforts.
Yeah, so like 5X-ing the DFC's budget would be a nice place to start. I mean, I think at the end of the day, though, Congress, a lot of this money which is being spent directly within the U.S., which I think is an easier sell on the Hill than, you know, this kind of like diplomacy. Is the U.S., does the U.S. really care if it's like a Chinese bridge or a U.S. funded bridge? And maybe we care a little bit more about, you know, who's signing up for which telecom system. But at the end of the day, I don't think the Belt and Road, for as much as it has caught the attention of think tankers in D.C., has really captured the imagination of Congress to the extent that they'd be willing to put real money behind a response.
Is that a mistake? I mean, you know, when you say the five times for DSF would be a place to start, one possibility is that we shouldn't be trying to respond to this kind of highly mercantile, you know, Chinese approach to economic development in other countries. We should do our thing, let them do their thing. I mean, is the Belt and Road Initiative something that we should be responding to at all, or should we just kind of let it happen?
Well, I have always said that we should be trying to get the Belt and Road put into the sort of international development framework that everyone else operates according to. And that's sort of where our first mistake was. But then we've just compounded it, I think, frankly, since then by trying to create now competing other frameworks going outside the Bretton Woods institutions and the development banks that are set up to do this kind of stuff. There probably needs to be reform at some of those Bretton Woods institutions. And if Congress was going to do something, I would love it if they would start to look at how to make the IFIs and the development banks and the Bretton Woods institutions, you know, more responsive to the needs that are out there in the world so that the Chinese doesn't have to, the Chinese aren't responding to the needs in the world that are unfilled by, you know, the institutions that were set up to fill those needs and where a lot of our money is, frankly. But, you know, I think there's a lot that can still be done to bring the Chinese inside the DAC, inside the Paris Club for debt refinancing, and inside the sort of framework for development banks and development assistance. But we've chosen to sort of not do that or kind of shun and ostracize instead of trying to work to do that. I think that's probably a mistake.
Yeah. One point that Susan made, I wanted to hammer home on the idea that like there aren't U.S. firms that are necessarily direct competitors with a lot of what China is offering on the Belt and Road. I mean, we can't make a high-speed rail to save our lives here in the U.S., whereas China, which is, you know, a developing country and has an enormous home market to kind of grow firms that do the sort of infrastructure investment, which can then be kind of translated abroad. And, you know, on the one hand, you know, the Belt and Road Initiative is seen as this like attempt for the Chinese government to, you know, expand its researches abroad, but it's also, you know, direct support for its own firms. And, you know, you see a lot of municipal sort of provincial banks subsidizing their own firms to do projects. So it has a much more straightforward kind of like domestic economic logic in China than a comparable effort would do in the U.S. So agree with Susan in that we need to really be creative about sort of working with other countries around the world who may have firms which are more suited to competing for pitches for the type of projects that the Belt and Road Initiative encompasses in so shaping America's response.
We have another question from Auntie, who is the only one who's not being shy today. Once again, the floor is yours.
Thanks again. So I was wondering if you could talk a little about rare earth minerals and what kind of control does China actually have over the stockpiles and production of these? And what results can we actually see in the economic environment right now? And what do you think the effects will be in the future? Thanks.
Jordan, what are your thoughts on rare earth minerals?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at these reports by the U.S. Geological Service, you see these pretty scary numbers for certain rare earths where, you know, 70% of one and 85% of another are coming out of China. But I think it's important to sort of recall the example that happened in Japan. in the early 2010s, where at I think over the in a fight over the Senkaku Islands, China decided it would stop its exports of rare earths to Japan. And there was, you know, a 3 to 6 months disruption. But by the end of that, Japan had found new supply, built out new mines around the world, because fundamentally, rare earths are not that rare. They are just not profitable to be mined in a lot of places around the world. And, you know, the U.S. used to have a ton of rare earth mining. You know, Silicon Valley had a lot of, you know, had a lot of mineral production in and around it. But America decided that it was not in our best interest, and it was sort of cheaper to do abroad. What you're seeing now with this act and others are sort of subsidies for the creation of secure supply chains, which will sort of feed down towards making these mining projects, which wouldn't necessarily be in the green without this geopolitical context, all of a sudden start to make sense. So I think rare earths are sort of important to watch, but I think the Chinese government really understands that this is a bullet that they can only fire once. Because once the US and the rest of the world realizes that rare earth supply out of China isn't something that can be trusted, very quickly, you know, within a sort of 1 to 2 year time horizon, a ton of capacity around the world will come online from India, from Australia, has a ton of like really strategic reserves in this regard. So I think it's not surprising to me that China has been so cautious in using this as a diplomatic lever, because there's really a pretty straightforward response, which isn't going to take a huge technological breakthrough. It's just going to take a lot of digging. And once that happens, this will no longer be a problem.
I would, though, want to like chime in and say that China has a comparative advantage in pursuing dirty mining projects in third world country, you know, in third countries. So, you know, there is a sort of an inhibition on the part of the developed world to do this in their own countries and also probably in third countries. So we should keep an eye on that. But I do think that, as Jordan said, rare earths aren't that rare. And if we really need them, we'll find them. Of course, the price may go up, but I think it's not something that, you know, we need to be overly concerned about.
Lisa Harris, the floor is yours.
If the U.S. tried to shape the international development entities to be a competitive alternative to Belt and Road, how would the other countries that are stakeholders react?
Well, I think that one of the problems is that the international development organizations and a lot of the development banks, especially, have become very laden with kind of bureaucratic processes, feasibility studies. There's just a lot of, you know, administration and bureaucracy and paperwork that really makes it so that projects take forever to get started. And I think developing countries have found that dealing with these processes have gotten kind of overwhelming, and there should be some streamlining done to that. I mean, this is a balance. We can't like zero risk every project in the international system. And so I think looking at ways to streamline, I think that would be something that most of the shareholders of the various banks would support, and certainly the recipient countries would support.
Right. The complication arises, though, when you have to say, okay, we're not going to do this review anymore, or we're not going to do this review anymore, because then these same constituencies and values that caused you to do them in the first place, you know, what, you don't care about the environment, what, you don't care about competitive bidding, right? I mean, the same factors that led you to do those reviews in the first place militate against the streamlining, no?
Well, sure. That's why it's a balance. I mean, I think we've really over-exaggerated on the one side, and it makes it almost impossible to get projects through now. Mm-hmm. And in fact, most of the development banks and the, you know, the IFIs have gone away from doing projects, which is why the field is open for China. So, you know, if there was, you know, a competitive bidder from the among that could be subsidized or helped out by one of the development banks, I think most recipient countries would welcome that. But the, you know, we just don't do those kind of projects out of the World Bank used to build dams, roads, bridges, you know, railroads, things. They don't do that anymore. And neither do the other development banks, because they've been sort of gotten gun shy about doing these kinds of things that can end up with sort of controversies, NIMBY type protests and other things. So, I mean, it's you know, there's got to be a balance. And I just think we've gone far away from that balance.
So, Jordan, this bill passes the House, I assume not coincidentally, on the day the Winter Olympics open in China. I assume that's a bit of a intentional thumb in the eye on the part of the congressional House leadership, although I don't know that. I'm curious how the Chinese have reacted both to the Senate legislation and to the House legislation, to what extent they've, you know, they've commented on these legislations and what response we should expect from them.
I haven't seen a ton. I think you know what we're seeing in this legislation is a product rather than like a direct contributor. I think you know you'll probably at some point seeing the Chinese government say that the screening of foreign money coming into U.S. education institutions is racist. You'll see that this money is kind of escalating a competitive dynamic. But at the same time, look, I think you could find. Pretty direct comparisons to a lot of this legislation in the Chinese system when it comes to sort of industrial policy, when it comes to, you know, looking at various, you know, the Belt and Road Initiative we've been talking about for the past 20 minutes. So I don't think anything is going to strike Beijing as particularly surprising. And, you know, maybe the most sort of inflammatory thing I think is probably the most praiseworthy, which is the piece of the bill which makes refugee, which makes asylum applications easier for former residents of Xinjiang. So that type of stuff is probably going to be the type of things to most rile up China. But at the same time, all of the industrial policy, you know, investment in education stuff, the centerpiece of the most recent five-year plan was Li Keqiang bragging about how he was going to boost investment in basic research and R&D. So it's interesting to sort of watch the two systems start to mirror each other more and more. And, you know, there are aspects, I think, that, you know, are worth considering. There are aspects which clearly I would never want in a million years for the U.S. to go down. But the fact of the matter is, you know, once you sort of are queuing yourself on China, there are going to be it becomes a reference point for the policies that are coming out. And, you know, the sort of appreciation for what it is that China does and doesn't do in Congress, I think, is, you know, mixed, and some representatives are more or less sophisticated about what sort of Chinese policy is and how it would make the most sense to respond to. But for sure, the sort of interplay is going to be a really interesting one to watch as the two countries respond to each other. You know, the outbound investment screening, for one, I think is, you know, you saw China develop its own version of FIRMA. If the U.S. ends up going down this road, I would be shocked if you wouldn't see the same type of legislation coming out of the Chinese system.
Susan, what are you expecting by way of response?
I just have to echo what Jordan said, and that I think it's really telling that the two systems are getting closer and closer to one another. And what we were trying to do was to make the Chinese system sort of, you know, shape it to be more in the direction of our system. And now we're going in the other direction. You know, I hope that's going to work out for us. I'm not sure. But I think, you know, the Chinese have already baked this in. They were very upset about the passage of USICA. That was, you know, 68 votes in the Senate, you know, bipartisan majority. There's not that much more in the House bill that, you know, I think will be any surprise to them or bring any new reactions. I think it's already baked in. They've already decided that, you know, this is sort of going to be our approach to them. And, you know, I don't think that there's going to be any major reaction to the passage of this House bill, whether it's on the first day of the Olympics or not.
You know, this is a real American tradition, and I think it's maybe a sort of global trend. Is like, you know, after World War II, the whole world was envious of the Soviet Union and its industrial capacity. So we, which is why we now have a DOD that has sort of the equivalent to 5-year plans and kind of acquisition cycles and funding cycles, which work on a 5-year time frame. In the 1980s, when America was really scared of Japan, we started working back towards industrial policy. We had managed trade became a hot topic. So I don't think it's, you know, super surprising that America is taking cues from its leading competitor on the world stage.
But what about the, you referred earlier to the Xinjiang provisions, but there's also Hong Kong provisions. There's, you know, a bit of in-your-face stuff about Taiwan. You know, you could see the Chinese taking these as, you know, very much inflammatory congressional actions, or you could see them saying, hey, we don't really care so much what Congress does. We care what the executive branch does. Susan, what do you think is the Chinese government, you know, going to treat this as a, you know, sort of symbolic posturing by the legislature, or as, you know, substantive reflections of U.S. policy with respect to issues that are kind of red lines for them?
Yeah, no, they'll definitely take it as, you know, inflammatory posturing, but also, you know, meddling in areas that are red lines for them. And I think what they have always said is that, you know, we use the Congress as kind of an excuse to not, you know, we let the Congress kind of fulminate about China policy, and the administration says, you know, we have separate branches of government, so, you know, that doesn't necessarily reflect what the executive branch and what our U.S. government policy is on various things. I mean, I think the Chinese are, you know, no longer really, I mean, they never accepted that, and they certainly don't now, but they know Biden's going to sign this bill if it gets passed. So, and it's going to have some of this inflammatory stuff in it, and they will be upset about that when it happens. But I think as far as their reaction to every single little step of the process up on the Hill, they're not going to be major reactions, you know, to this version of the bill, and they'll sort of be waiting to see what comes out. You know, I don't think the economic provisions, you know, are investing in ourselves and other things like that are going to, I mean, they're not going to have any reaction really to that. It's more the sort of gratuitous swipes that you just mentioned and some of the policies regarding their internal issues that would be most, and certainly the, you know, Taiwan language and the language about rallying with our allies to contain China, that kind of thing is going to be the most upsetting. And you'll see a lot about it in the Chinese press when and if this ever gets passed.
But what about the holistic packaging? Because you started by saying that the bill was kind of a grab bag anti-China competitiveness bill. And that's certainly the way a lot of people talk about it. I'm curious whether, and that has to be the way China will receive it, right? That, you know, Congress passed a big anti-China bill. It's not like the big Russia sanctions bill that they're also working on, but it is definitely a bill that says, hey, China is a big geostrategic threat and we have to get our house in order to deal with them. I gotta think that they would see that as the messaging of that as itself both flattering and threatening.
If I'm putting myself in Xi's shoes, I think I would take the same tack that Susan and I had, which is like, what took America so long? You know, again, it kind of comes back to the question of how much impact this bill is going to have. And, you know, I think the sort of like, you know, state council level response is, you know, probably should be the same as ours, which is that this is not something that is like radically going to improve America's trajectory and, you know, probably shouldn't like change their calculations of the balance of power 5 or 10 years down the line. I do want to come back Ben, to this idea of like what the Chinese response is going to be, because there was a funny little thing that happened a few months ago when the Chinese embassy in DC came out and said, you know, we disagree with the CHIPS Act and we think it's a bad thing you guys are doing. And all of a sudden, you know, Democrats and Republicans get out and said, oh man, I guess this means we really have to pass it. So there are these interesting dynamics where, like, I'm sure whoever the diplomats are in the Chinese embassy, in the embassy in the US, are probably smart enough to know that, like, calling out the exact thing they don't want to happen is probably going to increase the likelihood of that happening. But they have these incentives to sort of like make their voices heard and be seen in Beijing as sort of standing up for Chinese prerogative. So it's, I think, getting harder and harder for the Chinese foreign ministry to play a somewhat more sophisticated double game in which they could try to shape this type of legislation more towards Beijing's liking.
We are going to leave it there. Susan Thornton, Jordan Schneider, thank you both so much for joining us.
Thanks, Ben. Thanks, Susan.
Thanks, everybody.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. You can join future episodes of Lawfare Live and future podcasts taped in front of a Lawfare Live audience by becoming a material supporter of Lawfare on our Patreon page, patreon.com/lawfare. You can get Lawfare merch at the Lawfare store. And of course, you should leave a rating or review wherever you found us. The Lawfare podcast is edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our audio engineer this episode is Kara Schillen of Goat Rodeo. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.